This is Betty Smith, the 24th of February, 1990, Not Without Aphrodite, tape 3 of 6.
What's the last thing?
That's Zeus and the Thunder. Well, gnosis really just means knowledge or knowing in Greek. Mm-hmm. So it still doesn't explain what knowing is. Say it. Yes.
Speaking of the archetype, to me it would come from that, the childish things that you just know. We don't intuit them. Mm-hmm. You don't think them. Just know. Mm-hmm. So to me, what you're born with.
You know, there was that interview that was made of Jung, and if I'm not mistaken, was it made by the BBC? I don't know.
Yeah.
Was that the one where he said, and Dr. Jung, do you believe in God? And he said, okay, what did he say?
No,
I don't believe, I know. And he didn't say it, you know, boastfully. It was simply a simple source of where it came from. Came through without obstruction. That's the way it is. I don't think there are many things that we can have that experience of. And I don't think this kind of thing is going to be with us all every moment of the way. We're going to know like that. Like Dione, but no, these were not from the Homeric hymn. The only part that was from the Homeric hymn, this was from just the writing of the dialogue. The only part from the Homeric hymn was the last paragraph where the hours adorn her. This is all my writing, yes. Thank you. Where they placed the necklaces on her. The garland and the necklaces. And by the way, in case I forget to say it tomorrow, here it's the circle of gold on her head. But also in one of the Homeric hymns, it speaks of her wearing a crown of violets. And I really enjoyed reflecting on that and taking that into quiet and thinking about how different that is from our notion of a sex goddess. Or a goddess even of the temple courtesans, that it's difficult to find violets. Have you ever gone searching for violets? I mean, wild violets. I mean, if they're in the shade, they're near the roots. There's the root connection again. And they're a very shy and unassuming flower. And I think it says something about the nature of love and its non-behavioral aspect. Mm-hmm. It's not this big splashy thing that you're just going to know immediately.
They also wither really quickly.
Yeah.
Put them on your head, fresh,
you
go.
Yes. Right. They have to have a lot of moisture. Gentle moisture.
Interesting, but in France, in May, men give bouquets of violets to their lady
wives. They do. Oh, that's neat.
Really impressive.
That's neat.
In England, they traditionally give them to mothers on Mother's Day.
Really? The violets to mothers? Well, that's...
I associate violet with the color. Purple type king for
mm-hmm.
And so with that through the ages, the kings were the ones who could afford to kill all the little Triolian snails where they extracted the color purple. And so with a king went responsibility, and I think of her with that crown of violets, that her responsibility goes with love. She doesn't take it lightly.
No.
I love my family, I love my children, I love my mate, and I'm responsible for the flighty type of love.
Mm-hmm.
So I will pick a color.
Yes. Yes, Right. Well, a lot came out of that. Now, did somebody want to say something more about the birth myths? Lynn.
Yeah, here's a great book too. I'm just struck by the difference of this, the different feeling that this myth evokes in me and the one you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. where she was birthed out of the sea. And I was curious which one preceded, which one came first historically. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you were saying that you thought this one came from the older myth. And that really resonated for me because I feel much more connected to this birth story than I do that other story. And it's hard, in a sense, to hold how different they are. It's hard
yes.
for me to hold
yes.
how different they are.
Yes.
I guess I wanted to open that up a little bit.
Yes. All right.
Since you did mention the other myth.
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
If anybody can, has any questions about that, if you have anything to say.
I attempted to make a little bridge between them in the description of the second oracle. But now the second oracles are not found in the account of the myths. So I just had to give that to what might be the nature of it and give it as simply as possible. But in the second oracle, the bridge is made a little bit to the first myth. Out of the depths that run full, sighing on a thousand shores, she comes, borne lightly forward like foam of the sea. And then it says, daughter of Dione, wise earth, and so forth, and bringing the golden world which she sets on the earth. But there is a sense in which she belongs to the waters. And alchemically, it might help a bridge that she belongs to the realm of solutio. She puts the rigid things back into solution. She takes the dry things and again brings them moisture.
I think part of where I have the struggle is in this verse story, there's such a sort of a childlike joy between the two lovers.
Uh-huh.
Between Dione and Zeus, there's this wonderful dialogue, and there's a richness, and in that way that feels much lighter than to think of Uranus's.
Yes. Yes.
That was sacrificed and thrown into the sea. I mean, that's a very different feeling.
Yes, it's a very different feeling. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, it's a very painful beginning. I mean.
I think in this Dione myth, also the feminine and masculine qualities are better integrated.
Yes.
And I think that makes it more loving, actually.
Uh-huh. And speak to us in our times where we want more balance in relationship, I think. Somewhere there's the statement of Euripides that maybe I'll find by tomorrow, but he makes a wonderful statement about Aphrodite, and the loves that come from Aphrodite are the loves of really noble loves. Pindar speaks of the noble loves coming from Hera, but Euripides speaks of a very, very high noble love coming from Aphrodite. I'll try to find the statement for you. Tomorrow we're going to work with the love of Ares and Aphrodite. And in the background, Hephaestus. And Hephaestus's net. I consider Hephaestus's net very important. And so that's going to be... And then the wounded Aphrodite tomorrow. There are... I just like... for a few minutes to talk about some of the different forms that love comes in mythology, just very, very briefly. And then Okay, we'll see where we go from there. It's Zeus is often the lover. Often the lover. And of course, he's had very bad press for, what are the words used? I can't think of any of them. What?
Womanizer,
skirt chaser. All right, skirt chaser, womanizer, all those things. He doesn't deserve any of those, in my opinion. Well, this is, after all, he was a very, in his worship, a very high god of the Greeks. And this is a way of getting into human experience. This is a way of getting into the human world. This is the way of creating on earth for God, for Zeus, is to get an offspring, to find a mortal maiden. And he usually had mortal lovers. He usually had human women lovers. He had some nymphs and occasionally a goddess, but not very often. Hera, of course, is his wife. But I mean, his other loves were usually women. And it's certainly not rape in any sociological sense that we understand rape today. Quite often, I mean, Zeus woos and takes a maiden or a woman and misgives it so short that you think it just, he grabs her and that's it. So we don't know. But the point is that this happening, the consequences of it must be looked at carefully. Always when a woman has borne a child to Zeus, she receives great honor. Her child receives honor. And she has a very protected, good life. And I think the same was usually true with the loves of Poseidon, but not without exception. For example, Medusa was an exception. She didn't do so well. And she was loved by Poseidon in the temple of Athena. It was just the wrong place and the wrong time, Athena thought. And there's a great deal in my Io dialogues. There's a lot of mourning and sadness on the part of Io when she's separated from Zeus after loving Zeus, and she has to bear the pregnancy all by herself. Well, that's what it means to be a woman or a human being, to be a soul fertilized by a god. Then you have to carry it all by yourself. You don't have a god in residence coming for breakfast, lunch, and dinner and helping with the dishes. I mean, really don't. And so it's tough. And but that is the nature of that's the transcendence of the god and the transcendence of these numinous experiences for us when they come into our life, when they come to the soul, when they come to psyche in us. And Zeus is one of those great lovers. And Poseidon is another one of the great lovers. Of all the male gods, probably the most faithful was Dionysos, surprisingly, who stayed with his wife Ariadne. And he was really quite a faithful husband god. He was the bridegroom god. In myth, in ritual, he was the bridegroom god. Now, so some of the forms in which Zeus has come, yes, Terry.
Hades and Persephone, though, you would call a maiden.
Yeah, Hades was one of the great.
Which is what you're saying, that you would never call Zeus's love rape.
No, nor would I call Hades' love a rape.
Well, that's what I wondered.
No. I know it's been called the rape of Persephone. Absolutely not. She became his queen. Persephone became the queen of the underworld. Her offspring was forever immortalized. Her offspring was Dionysos, the mystical Dionysos. Sometimes he's called her husband, sometimes he's called her offspring, usually the offspring.
Of Persephone?
Mm-hmm. Hades Dionysos, they say. They say sometimes in the mysteries.
I know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And besides, Hades went and got permission from her father. Yes, that's in the Homeric hymn. Didn't go for to the mother, but he went to the father to get permission to take the daughter, to take Persephone. I don't regard any of these as rapes. Excuse me?
Excuse me. I'm not clear about what you're saying. Yeah. I'm not clear about, because of the honor afforded the woman afterwards,
mm-hmm.
then it's not rape? I don't quite understand.
No.
I'm not following you.
Well, I feel that it must not be a violent taking of the woman, even though it was the initiative of the male god in each case. It was his initiative. But I feel as if, I mean, and that's just a matter of conjecture on my part, except to look at the consequences, which are not conjecture. And these women that were loved by the gods received great honor and status, usually. And
even though it was then forcibly.
Well, there's some question. I mean, even about Persephone, they say, you know, what was she doing there? You know, as if she really knew, it was as if it was her fate. But she was looking for something. She was wandering away from her mother. She was wandering away from friends. She was alone.
Well, yes, and I think carrying off the woman without her permission, that came into history too. As if you want, I don't call that specifically rape. That remained in the Greek wedding ceremony for a long time. In the Greek Greek wedding ceremony, the bridegroom goes to the house of the bride, grabs the bride, and carries her off. Of course, they've already agreed to be married and so forth, but I mean, it must be reliving the sudden taking. And the bridesmaids tear at him and whatever, try to get her back. They go through a whole play of that sort. I don't think it. I don't know. I don't see in the literature. I don't see the effects of wounded women from rape. I mean, in the literature, in the poetry or the myths. I don't see that. That the high stature and the children born of those and the recognition by the gods owning their children and favoring them is usually, just seems to me very different from rape. Mm-hmm. But certainly the initiative was stronger on the man than on the woman. That was an ancient tradition, that it was stronger. I mean, the man decided he wanted the woman, and anyway, that's all at issue. But I think in the inner world, which is what I'm most concerned about, is that it's very important for the god to come and woo the soul, to woo, to come and win the soul. And the powers of Aphrodite are there. Zeus recognized the powers of Aphrodite overcoming him. He felt helpless before Aphrodite. Sometimes he says in the one of the Homeric hymns to Aphrodite, one of the two. But there were certain goddesses she had no effect upon: Artemis and Hestia and Athena. Now, I'd like to just mention some of these forms that Zeus appeared in. The bridegroom comes, whether to a man in his soul or to a woman. One great form that Zeus comes in is the bull. He came to Europa as the bull. The bull. She played with the bull beside the sea, far up in Thessaly, and petted the bull and strung garlands around his neck. We have that in poetry, ancient poetry. And then she happened to climb on his back, and away he went with her. That's called the abduction of Europa. Abduction is more in the ancient Greek tradition, abduction. Okay. So he came as a bull. On Crete, Zeus would have been quite associated with the bull god. Both Dionysos and Zeus are the same god on Crete and in early days on the island of Crete. And the bull was very close to them. The goddess they called the mistress was very strong on Crete, and the bull was close to her. So the bull god was her consort on Crete. Anyway, the bull is a very important form of Zeus, and sometimes they speak of Dionysos having a bull foot. A bull foot. But only once have I seen it in art. There are a lot of Dionysoses painted in ancient Greece, but only once have I ever seen the bull foot. So he comes as a bull. Then, when he came to Leda, he came as what?
Swan.
As the swan. She was a queen of Sparta in the south of Greece. There was a lovely river flowing there, and she used to spend times on the riverbank. And here came the great swan. And it was Zeus. And he does like to surprise you. I warn you. Then let's see, what were some of the other forms?
And then who was the...
What?
Who was the offspring, the bull that went down into...
Oh, the Minotaur?
The Minotaur. That was the offspring of Zeus and
Electra. That was the offspring of Pasiphaea, the queen of Crete, and the bull of Poseidon. Not Poseidon. Well, it's a question of whether it was Poseidon himself or the bull.
Well, Ariadne would be that
myth. She is. She's a half-sister. Ariadne became fused in Crete and Cyprus with Aphrodite. So she is a form of Aphrodite. Let's see, what other forms?
Was there an offspring of Europa and Zeus?
A what?
Was there an offspring from the Europa and Zeus?
I think so, but I don't remember the name.
From a lady comes Helen, Troy, and Castor.
Right. Castor and Pollux, Helen and Clytemnestra. Mm-hmm. But only two of them were Zeus's, and the other two were her husband. Is that right? There were two eggs, but I mean, yes. Pollux and Helen were the children of Zeus.
There's this kind of a cloud to you.
Yes, he comes as a cloud to Io. There's the form. Zeus comes as a great cloud. I think this is more often experienced by the soul than any other form. It's just a big, vague cloud. But one which catches one up and can be quite numinous and quite captivating. All right, now what else have we got? Cloud.
Shower of gold.
Shower of gold. He comes to whom? Danae. All right. And
she comes to her husband. To the mother of Heracles.
He comes as her husband. Yes, yes. That's not an animal form. Comes as the husband to the. That happens too. Comes as the husband to Alcmene. Is that her name? Alcmene. Mm-hmm. Comes as Amphitryon. All right. Now let me see. Anyway, those are some of the forms. And to Hera, he came as the cuckoo. So what I would like to do is, I just want to read you a rather short dialogue of the cuckoo, scepter, and the Zeus's coming to Hera in this form. And then as we leave, I wanted you to each have one of the little images to draw. And these are various forms. Some of them are repeated of that we've just been discussing, the forms of the beloved or the lover coming. Okay? Zeus beheld the goddess of Argolis, a radiant beauty of cool countenance and sovereign brow. And in her right hand he observed a golden scepter on which the spring cuckoo perched. Seeing the bird that did not take flight, familiarly resting upon the small golden globe, he raised his eyebrows at the same instant that a lightning thought flashed in his eyes. Ah, so you are the little creature that lays your eggs in some other bird's nest instead of in your own. And what does it matter to you that the other is not forewarned, but all unsuspecting? And with these words of the great Lord of the gods, Hera looked up, but she had not caught the words he uttered. What brings you, Zeus, my lord, to green Argolis? Don't remember how this goes. He said, it occurred to me that I'd like to look in on you in your own kingdom, or rather, queendom. And spring in Argolis is unparalleled in the whole of Greece, it is said. That is so. Spring is my season, you see, and I'm always here for it when it is ready, however much my travels take me about. You yourself are a vision of spring, Hera, that fills my eyes and swells my heart. You are all the shining, lithe river nymphs or dancing nymphs of Pan that I have ever seen. But then, you do renew your virginity every spring or summer, I'm told, in some spring hereabouts. And she laughed. Who has told my secrets? In any case, I shall not reveal to you the spring itself. Well, that's quite all right, since I have no need of it, he said. Indeed, she said. Come, have I offended you when I only let slip the facts? I was watching your little bird, Hera, the cuckoo. Isn't she dear and so faithful to me? She is never out of my sight. By Olympus, do you regard that as a virtue? My eagle is ever out of my sight. Faithfulness is surely a virtue, Hera said. I were not queen here if I did not require it. What is faithfulness, Hera, my love? It is a knowing to whom one belongs and a constancy that keeps that tie secure. In faithfulness, there is no wandering, no interruptions. I'm sorry, I didn't remember the content of this too well. Let's see. I think it still might be to the point. She said there are no wanderings and no interruptions in faithfulness. And Zeus says, my dear, I shouldn't have thought so. You dare to oppose me in Argolis? Her temper flared. Is it that you know nothing of faithfulness? Two questions at once, both of them spearing me sharply. Forgive me if I turn to your bird, the faithful cuckoo. Have you noticed her habits in late springtime? What do you mean? That she's happy to lay her eggs, providing that they not be put down in the nest at hand, but she rather finds them some alien nest to receive her young, relieving her of the natural mothering. Can it be? Oh, well, she really is quite charming, don't you think? If charm is what is at issue, yes. But faithfulness? Oh, Zeus, do not be tiresome. I have never been so regarded, he said. Yet those who would call faithful, I guess it means, yet those who would call me faithful are likely to be tiresome, I should think. Tell me, is it true that you are a lover of other birds also? Of the partridges, yes. I do like birds very much. Why do you ask? Do you plan in the future to bring me a bird? The gift of a bird? Perhaps, yes, perhaps. The future is for the birds. And now, farewell until we meet again, beloved Hera. Sometime later, Hera had left her temple in Argos on the mountain and was walking to a high mountain meadow strewn with white May flowers. Her flower is the Asterion, the star flower. Her scepter and her diadem are not with her. The warm breeze lifts the voluminous folds of her peplos and makes them buoyant. She stops when suddenly she meets 100 great eyes of startling blue pulsing upon the ground before her. Why, it is the magnificent tail of a great peacock. I thought for a moment that all the eyes of heaven had dropped into my path. Great bird, show me your face. How did you come here to this isolated meadow? The bird does not turn, but continues to spread the fabulous green and blue tapestry of its tail feathers, the large blue eyes silently regarding her without winking. And Hera said, I should prefer not having those eyes upon me with their obscure sight. Show me your face instead. The peacock turned with slow, measured grace and looked at the goddess. There was another chapter to this that I apparently didn't bring. This was a gift of Zeus to Hera, is the peacock. According to some myths, it was his gift to her. And the eyes on the peacock were the eyes from the slaying of Argos, Argus, A-R-G-U-S, when Hermes slayed Argus to free Io, the heifer, for her journey. The 100 eyes of Argus were put into the peacock tail. And the peacock did become her bird. In the one that the chapter I thought I was bringing you, is Zeus takes the form of the cuckoo one day, and before he is her husband, and comes to her and alights in her bosom. And she pets the bird and just thinks the bird is wonderful. It's the bird of her scepter, too. And then Zeus assumes his godly form and presses her to be with him in love. And that supposedly was the way he wooed her, was as her own bird. And I'd just like to ask you now, in just the few moments that remain, what would it mean for the god to come as some small creature that you're familiar with? Say, as your own bird, for example, to take that form.
I'd be a lot more likely to reveal who I really am.
Yeah. Two, if he came in that challenging a form. Yeah, much more likely to reveal.
Interesting.
Why does he come in that form, other than that?
As a girl, you know, is approaching puberty or into it, so they each have a fantasy of being taken in some form. So if they meet that very form that is their fantasy, they're more likely to give into it and go with it. That love comes in the form that one dreams of, fantasizes, and images.
The images one has already chosen. And she obviously had chosen the cuckoo image, hadn't she?
So then I would see, as you say, not the rape, but the giving in to what one has already imaged.
Yes, in this case.
Knowing what one was really imaging, because I do take these are very young maidens.
In other words, Zeus could have said, you know, I really am your bird. I mean, you already decided that a long time ago. See, I'm already your bird. Right. Well, it is a very unlikely form, and it seems strange that, I mean, the bull seems to fit Zeus. Oh, and the great serpent, erect serpent, he comes to Persephone in the cave. In the Cretan myth, as a great serpent, and becomes her bridegroom. In a Cretan myth, but the idea of a little bird doesn't seem very Zeus-like.
It made me think of having a baby, and how the baby becomes like a cuckoo's egg. You know, they become teenagers. It's like totally different from when you were a little tiny baby. Yeah, the baby is like a little familiar, like the cuckoo, who then becomes, changes into God, or changes into something that isn't you, that whole mixing. And how by the time they become a teenager, an alien, present, a separated person, you know, you're in the egg in your nest. It's too late for you to do anything. You're connected. You
know, you're right. What would you feel about the fact that that Hera is the most faithful of all God's spouses, and who emphasizes faithfulness with a capital F? But the bird that she chooses to put on the top of her scepter in a ruling place, is this bird laying its eggs all over the place in everybody else's nest?
Well, I thought that's what he was saying to her, that she loves many different birds, but she's not as faithful as she would assume she is. She gives in, she loves the other bird, she's trying to show her.
Well,
as you think, you're not just faithful to the cuckoo, you love many birds, just as he loves many women.
All right. Okay. Yes.
It's really a measure of possessiveness in Hera's love. She wants to possess, and I think she's really totally in touch with her shadow side.
That's her shadow side, yes. And we hear more about that side in the classical age. Actually, earlier, in all fairness to the earlier Hera in the Peloponnesus at Argos, where she was supreme, she was a great goddess. She was not a vengeful, she was not spending all her time as a vengeful wife. She was, it took Zeus some time to win her, actually. She was supreme in the south of Greece, and then he married her and began to share some of the power there in the south of Greece, at Olympia, for example. And but we do get that view. I just wanted to put in a good word for Hera, because if you want to study the cycle of a woman, you should look at Hera. She's got a wonderful thing about cycle of a woman. Well, I want to give these This is just for your musing, pondering on, and when you go home. And just see what comes. Each of these represents, I think, Zeus in some form or other. I think they're all Zeus. And if you'll draw one, and all right. First, a few comments about the dialogues about the approach to myth that I really failed to give you any kind of an introduction to that yesterday, but very few comments so we can get into the myths themselves. In writing the dialogues, which developed as a, you know, kind of fell out upon me, I in a kind of active imagination process, it does involve a kind of active imagination process, but it's not the ego versus the ego meeting the character, but an attempt to stand with one's consciousness, unconsciousness within each figure of the dialogue. But there is an attempt to stay faithful to the myth as known. The various incidents of the myth, and I do use ancient sources primarily for the myths. Apollodorus's Greek library, which comes from early Christian era, I mean something like 1st to 2nd century. You want a place to sit, don't you? Can you hear it? Yes. And an Ovid's Metamorphoses. Ovid was writing in the 1st century A.D. He's much more of the lusty, gusty Roman, but a marvelous writer. And the Homeric hymns, Pindar's Odes, the poet of late 6th, early 5th century B.C., Hesiod, the Theogony particularly, using ancient sources to get the details, the qualities and the details of the myth. Sometimes the myth is very, very brief, and then the dialogue becomes an amplification. But you will notice that the dialogue does not introduce, usually does not introduce any new action. I mean, it's primarily a relationship, kind of, between the characters and around the action of the myth. But the one thing I wanted to emphasize is not just trying to stay faithful to the myth, but it's important to realize that the encounter in the dialogue is with a contemporary psyche. I mean, namely, mind is all I can bring to it. But also something of the collective contemporary psyche is in it. And I think it's there is a value in re-encountering the myths and reinterpreting the myth in the generation in which you live. And so that's what's happening. So there is a modern flavor of psyche, of the psyche in the dialogues. And I don't know what it would even mean to be historically accurate about a myth. I mean, I take the structure that's given by the ancients. In that sense, I'm historical. But to be historically accurate, or what did Zeus really think? Instead of your dialogue, what did he really think? Or what did Dione really say? Who knows? And so it seems to me that that is the point at which we give it to the life of the psyche. And when a myth is greatly amplified, like Demeter and Cory myth occurs even with certain dialogue in the Homeric hymns, then I I don't usually work with that in dialogue. I don't need to. The amplification is right there. Sometimes I do a little on the side. But and I try to work with it, contemporary psyche, but try to stay within the ancient context, the ancient gesture, the ancient ritual, and the ancient feel that I get from the study of the ancients with the gods. I mean, there is a respect for the gods in the dialogues, attempting to see and experience each god in his particular or her particular majesty. Even where there's humor. I mean, sometimes it's humanized, but it's... I don't think it ever belittles the gods. And myth, I would like to say something else, because yesterday I said something to validate an opinion of Aphrodite, and I say, but this is what the myths say. And I saw a kind of puzzlement on a face or two, and I need to explain that when I use the word myth, I'm speaking of archetypal truth as myth amplifies the archetypal world. So it does bear a very strong truth, myth does. It's not like historical truth. It's actually more powerful than historical truth. History is bent and molded by the archetypes. So I never use myth in that kind of corrupted way. I consider it very corrupted. To say something is a myth, meaning it's not true. I think it's really too bad that we have allowed myth to fall in. I recall this was before he died in battle, and that wasn't precisely the story I meant to tell you, but let's see. But there was another incident in which Solon advised a king, a Greek king. He was getting wealthy, and so he took his most valuable jewel and hurled it into the sea. Now, this was not Minos hurling his ring before Theseus, but he hurled it into the sea in order to bring equilibrium into his life. Nothing too much. Apollo said at Delphi, nothing in excess, nothing too much, which is not a compromise. It's not a milquetoast little or a rational, absolute middle of the road way, but it still has some sense of a tension between opposites is what you have to live. And that's the Greek balance. Anyway, so maybe, you know, the jewels of Aphrodite are too much, and that's why it has such a Greek ending, tragic Greek ending. But I still think it says something to us on a symbolic level of that it's good to be stirred by the desire for Aphrodite's realm. And then what do we do with it? How do we realize it? How do we give it ground? That's the next question. And I don't think we send out our heroic side. I mean, I think maybe we've seen that that was not the way to go. Although it's fear and trepidation, I make a sweeping statement on a legend because... I usually say things happen as they will happen. I don't think there's any simple moral to be gotten out of the story, except that this way of towards Aphrodite didn't really work. It reveals that. Now, I'd like to take you back to a place of the beginning of Aphrodite. We said there was another birth myth, and that the birth myth is important because that's the point where the God burst into human experience, into human existence. That you can't bring a God to Earth just any way, and concepts alone won't do. But there are ways in which she enters. And one of these is the, it's not the sea birth myth, but the myth that comes from ancient Dodona, which was one of the earliest settlements in Greece, D-O-D-O-N-A, Dodona. It's in the Pindus Mountains on the west side of the Pindus Mountains. The Pindus Mountains are very rugged. Until a year or two ago, there was no paved road from the east over the whole mountains and impassable in the winter time. They are very rugged, and they still have kind of rugged little mountain village places there. But it's not so far from the sea on the west side. Dodona. It's in a lovely little valley, not spectacular, but very secluded, with oak trees. And it was, there came to be a very great sacred oak in this place, sacred oak tree. And a goddess reigned there. She may have been brought from Egypt. And her name was Dione, D-I-O-N-E. She might have been brought from Egypt. It's not really pronounced with a hard D. It's more like Dione. It simply means goddess. Theos, Dione. Theos, more like T-H. And she was brought by two priestesses who were called the doves, these priestesses. They were called the doves, and I'm not sure why they were called the doves. Now, I presume that already the dove image was associated with the goddess because it was early associated with the great enthroned goddess figures of Mycenae. You see a little clay votive figure of a enthroned goddess, and just under her bosom she often supports a dove. A bird that looks very much like a dove. So I would presume that Aphrodite, being an earth goddess, might very well have had the doves with her image. But they also said that the priestesses might have sounded like doves when they were chanting, because the Egyptian religion, the Egyptian language was so different. But however that may be, she is served by priestesses here. And later, Zeus came, and Zeus shared the oracle, and I'm sure it'll be upsetting to many of you, but he came to be known as the god of the oracle here. This was Zeus's only oracle on earth in which he spoke directly with the petitioner. And it was Dione's method, and Dione, but I like the fact that the sharing period in which they shared it together. The oracle was read from the vibrating, the trembling of the oak leaves. Remember that? Some of you who've studied that. There was never a temple. It was an outdoor sanctuary. It had a little wall around the temenos. And there were cauldrons later, bronze cauldrons put in a circle, a large circle around the sacred oak. And later there were priests as well as priestesses, and they would sound a sound on the first cauldron when a question was given to the oracle, and the vibration would travel through all the whole ring of cauldrons, just on and on and on, and then the oracle would be given. And the priests lived on, and I imagine the priestesses too, their main substance, their main nurture was acorns. You know, they made cakes out of acorn flour and ground the acorns.
Now, I'm just going to read you part of this because we have other myths coming. I'll tell you the first part of the story. I should tell you where this is found. For one thing, one place that there is a good deal of interesting reading on Dodona with the myth is Melos's book, Temple and Sanctuaries, Temples and Sanctuaries of Ancient Greece. Melos, M-E-L-A-S. If you happen to find the book, it's not in print. I'm going to begin with a point where a stranger approaches to Dodona, to the sanctuary, this remote sanctuary. Apparently, they've had an oracle from Dione that had said that that there would be a stranger coming someday. Somebody coming, that there would be a change here in the place of the oracle. So this is the time of the stranger's coming. He comes in an approaching chariot. He drew up where a kingly figure wearing armor and a goatskin aegis, and he leapt lightly to the ground and strode forward. And he reached the circle of the sacred mighty oak tree and slowed his pace and looked wonderingly at the tree. So, this is the place. This empty shaded circle far from cities of men. The place where the divine voice enters the human world directly. Here the divine speech is not poured first into a woman, filling her throat with chanting ecstasy, as at Delphi with Apollo's oracle. And then he turned and he beheld the approach of a stately woman, neither maidenly nor tall, a queen whose sovereignty filled him with unexpected happiness as she drew near and lifted her face in greeting. Her full light peplos was fastened at the waist with a slender girdle of silver, and on her head she wore a garland of summer flowers. And it's Dione. And she said simply, "You are expected." She spoke in simple acknowledgement, even resignation, he thought, his eyes upon her. "This is astonishing," he said. "How could you have known of my coming?" "Ah, yes, the oracle, the ancient oracle that's here." "Yes, it was through my oracle that I knew. Knowing is a thing like glass, in which the light finds no obstruction, none whatsoever. Knowing passes through so many walls. Walls of sound as the beating of wings or the trembling of the oak leaves. Knowing penetrates soft walls of flesh, and even hard walls of old belief may not stand against it." I know one thing for certain, that I am in the presence of the goddess. At this moment, I'm not sure that I'm ready, he said. "Not ready? You?" She laughed at this. "Can Zeus be found at a loss?" "I am not so unwise, nor so confident, for that matter, as to overlook the fact that I have entered the territory of a great goddess. From Zeus the Olympian, I never expected to receive such acknowledgement." "Why," he said, "do you doubt your power over me?" "Perhaps," she said. He said, "can you believe that I have longed to come to you in your dwelling place, yet something did not allow me?" "Strange," she said. He said, "here I have no power. None at all."
Nor do you have need of such in Dodona, surely, she said. The very notion caused her to shudder involuntarily. As my guest, you shall have as fine hospitality as we have to give. Dodona is my dwelling place, as you yourself have pointed out. My priestesses shall see to your comfort. Go to now, he said. I shall enjoy myself completely. And he smiled his most disarming smile, which is supposed to be pretty disarming. And so on and on, and they enjoyed many hours and many days together. And here one day they talk about the oracle. This seems like an aside from Aphrodite, but this is her background. So I think it's important. Zeus said, dear goddess, tell me, how old is your oracle here? It is beyond time, it is so old. Do your priestesses not guard a recorded history? No, in Dione's land, nothing is written down. We are said to be without written language. In Dodona, my speech is heard only. Well, that explains what I have sensed here, giving me feelings of enormous cleansing and relief. Speech here, Zeus says, speech here is true, a virginal thing such as you express moment by moment in your being. The word arises always afresh. It is never collected, prized until it goes stale, never adored as if words were something in themselves. A separate life to be lived. So in 2 days you have come to see this? I am astonished, Zeus, since my world is so different from yours. Love does not cease to open the eyes, he said. She said, here at Dodona, the word is not separated from myself, my presence. That is why you find it as living act and gesture. One is not the same after Dodona's word, it is true. Everyone who comes here is as changed as I am, Zeus asked. Oh no, certainly not. What is crucial is the hearing. Dodona, with its vast silence, its mountain walls of enclosure, its solitude, provides the possibility of hearing. And the bronze cauldrons summon one to the encounter with the divine speech. Just as they close out unwelcome influences. Yet one still may not be able to hear, although my ways are gracious with supplicants. Dione, your word is mysterious indeed. It is your word that assails me now, confounds all my senses, fills me with delight, or something akin to child play, or else ecstasy. That word, which is yourself, yes, is lush and full and gentle and smiling, honey dripping slowly from the comb. Come, take my hand. And they run over the field like children. And then he comes to ask her after, you know, I don't really know how many days this took, but in the dialogue it took a few days. He lets it be known that he wants her to be his love and his wife. And I think she goes then to consult the oak tree, goes to have her own communion with the sacred oak tree to get an answer. Wait here, I must consult the sacred oak. And she goes, and there's a period of silence, and then there's the sound, there's a trembling in the oak leaves, And the bronze cauldrons begin this low, mysterious sound, vibrating sound. And Zeus stands beside her then, and at last he says, "What does the oracle say?" And she repeats the oracle to him, that day's fruit shall not be passed over. Day's fruit shall not be passed over. That as earth receives the lightning, Dione shall receive Zeus. And a magical goddess will yet come to earth. And so this became their wedding day, and he takes her as his love. And they, in time, come to share this same oracle. But I do want to say this about the power of Dione. This is the only place on earth that Zeus has this direct voice, and it's through a tree. He's very much a sky god. He's not spoken through trees before. And you would be most surprised at where he comes to dwell. He comes to dwell in the roots of the sacred oak tree with Dione. Their dwelling place is in the roots of the sacred oak tree. And I believe this is the persuasion of Dione that draws him into such a place, which also sounds, we'd say, phonic, which sounds underworld, and more a place for an earth goddess to be in the roots than a sky god drawn there. And I would think that would affect the oracle a great deal, the fact that it comes out of this tree. So there is then a second oracle. She's pregnant. Dione is pregnant. It's time for her child to be born. She calls her priestesses and tells them to sound the bronze cauldrons, and she herself goes into the circle by the mighty oak and stands in the silence, and the birth pains come over her, the contractions. And she says, "My time has come. The fruit of Dione and Zeus has ripened, and the day awaits it with eager hands. Did not the oracle counsel me to take Zeus's love in order that the magical goddess may come forth?" And now she gave a sign for her priestesses to leave her. And then she says, addressing the unborn child, "Wait, daughter of mine." The oracle speaks once more. Nor is it Zeus's voice, but a voice of her earth herself, I believe. And this is the second oracle. Out of the depths that run full, sighing on a thousand shores, she comes, borne lightly forward like foam of the sea. Daughter of Dione, wise earth, and her name is Aphrodite. From her step the flowers bloom, within her hand the fruit grows sweet. A golden world is set on earth, which all unknowing shall call love, as beauty's wonder issues forth. Dione was moved by the oracle, and she turned and asked the sacred tree, "Tell me, will my daughter bring gifts of joy alone to mortals and immortals?" And the voice said, "A goddess of great delight she shall be to all, but after her trails a shadow of sorrow. Adored and dreaded alike shall she be." Then Dione cried out loud, and Aphrodite came forth upon the ground, a woman Usually gods are born fully developed, usually. A woman, full-bosomed, of lovely face and form, whose great beauty caused Dione to gasp in awe. And Aphrodite looked fondly into the face of Dione. Dear mother, how I have longed for the day which now you have given me. You and I, we know, don't we? And with this she laughed gaily. Now three goddesses, radiant and smiling, appeared beside Aphrodite. Over their arms they carried fine and gossamer garments with which they began to dress the goddess of love. When Aphrodite and Dione had nodded to the hours, these are the hours, on her head they placed a garland of worked gold, and upon her ears they placed flowers of copper and gold. This description is taken from the Homeric hymn now. On her ears, copper and gold, and about her lovely neck they placed a necklace of gold, which they themselves had made for her. And when she was fully addressed and adorned by the goddesses, she set out for the seashore to make her maiden voyage to the world of mortals. Thus it is always said that Aphrodite is she who arrived from the sea, coming ashore first at the isle of Kythera, which is off the tip of the south of Greece. Only Dione and Zeus know that she is daughter and granddaughter of wise earth, and that her ground is the oldest in the human soul. So that's the birth of, that's the northern Greek birth myth. And quite often, Zeus acknowledges, I think in Homer and a few other places, he calls her daughter, calls Aphrodite daughter. Well, I let you respond anywhere you like with this. I wonder what it means, let me just ask this much, what it means that to you, this mythological image that that Zeus resides, when Aphrodite is conceived, Zeus is in the tree, resides in the tree. Yes, mm-hmm. And Dione.
Mm-hmm. He is really a sky god, and he has come, and really, when he came to Dione, he was humbling himself, and almost, and so you are the oldest, and it seemed like he was much more humble than he should have been. And putting himself in the tree, it's almost a bowing before the goddess, and putting himself down in the earth, and it's a nice bend in the work.
Even more so than her mother and her root, rather than just that she fell in love, but it was just out of the water and the male seed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a more rooted sort of feeling of her
birth. More rooted sense of her whole birth, uh-huh.
I like
her
having a mother.
Yeah, I like her having a mother too. Uh-huh. Yes.
I also get the sense of Zeus as the ruler being able to let go of a lot of that stuff and just. He seemed to be very at peace and in a great deal of comfort in being able to reside with her there.
Yes.
And he didn't have to be the masculine ruler setting down limits for others to follow. Just let go of a lot of that stuff.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. He really was influenced. He was really persuaded by the place. Uh-huh. Yes, uh-huh. Really. So there's a lot of Aphrodite quality in Dione, I think, must have been.
With Aphrodite's numbers, too, it's curious, too, that the oracle, the oak tree, had to speak twice to get everything.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Right. Had to speak twice to get her here. That's right. Right.
Again, you sort of have that union of father, sky, mother, earth, spirit, father, you know, the union.
Of spirit and earth. Uh-huh.
Like enunciation, again, that he didn't respond, whatever, you know, how it is.
You mean you feel like the spirit coming into the body and Zeus coming into the tree? Is
well, because of the sky.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Right, right. Mm-hmm. I do think it makes a... It does seem to me to round something out that she's on the earth and born on the earth. But what does it mean that her mother is a goddess of wisdom? You see, there she wasn't the only goddess that had an oracle. I mean, the goddess who preceded Apollo at Delphi was Ge Themis, the earth goddess, and her daughter. And the oracles, the earth goddess had an oracle. So, but nevertheless, she is descended from that kind of wisdom, some kind of wisdom. We don't usually associate that with Aphrodite. But do you get the sense that it's a different kind of word? It's a different kind of wisdom. That there is a gesture, an act of being in the moment. That it is a word that's formed out of that. It's much closer to life.
A
word that's formed out of act and gesture in the moment and feeling. And it was somewhere said here when Zeus was saying that, when he said the word is virginal and fresh here.
And spontaneous.
And he says you can't save it up, apparently, or something like that. He was trying to figure it out, I think. Uh-huh. What'd you say, Lynn?
I said, and spontaneous. There was
yes, there was more spontaneity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Also, I think in wisdom, there are seeds for the woman to be wise in old age, where she becomes really a person for all seasons.
Yes, right. I think that's really important. Yes, that, and that's here in the older, mature form of Aphrodite. Uh huh.
Why did she say we know? What do we know?
Why did she what?
She said we know.
We know. Well, I don't know.
I don't think he was, but he also knows. That's why I asked my name, and she didn't know.
I once had a glimpse of something there, but dear mother, how I've longed for the day which now you have given me. You and I, we know, don't we? With this she laughed gaily.
Is it Joe from Zeus?
You can reject anything you like on that one. There was a...
So it seems to me that brought a new aspect to everybody that I didn't know before in terms of Zeus coming there and being a father. That there was a... you spoke of, like, the ability to act and the ethics of us being around. A masculine... It makes her more whole.
Uh-huh, yes.
She's not an airhead.
Okay. No, she's got more root than air. Uh-huh. I was looking for there was a little dialogue about the day, and the fact that Aphrodite says, I think this is it, Aphrodite says, "You have given me the gift of the day," says that to her mother, "You've given me the gift of the day." So I presume, you know, she's been in the dark until she's born. There's this little part here. Dione complains to Zeus earlier. Oh, all right. She says earlier, in coming to Dodona, saying this to Zeus, "Have you not worn your armor for the encounter with me? From afar I have long observed you, male Olympian." This is before she accepts him. See? "You form a plan, a purpose that goes forth like a warrior armed for battle. And that purpose enslaves the day and the hours to serve it." "Yes, I do not deny this," he said. "But don't you see? The day is trampled. It is used up. Oh, it grieves me to think of it. You see, Zeus, the day is mine." And I thought that was a strange statement. "The day is yours? What do you mean? Tell me, what is the day of which you speak? Believe me, I do not wish to distress you so greatly." "I am distressed because it's the best that I have. The day is our only measure, mortals and immortals alike. I tell you that Zoe lives only in the day, life. Life lives only in the day, in the hours of present time. Day is from the hand of the earth goddess, one of whose names I bear. Oh, what are past and future compared to the day, shining and unspent, warm as breathing flesh? Ah, Dione, frankly, such things have never occurred to me. I thought that the day was a road stretched forth for the horses to tread upon, a road to fill with ruts made by one's chariot wheels in its pursuits. No more. Are you not beginning to perceive that day is my creation, deeply stepped with hours, a thing soft flesh, pulsing with Zoe? And know that day moves according to its own season. Faintly, I see it," he said. "This superb natural creation of yours that's so invisible, and I must add, so seductive. Day, the dawn of day, was wooing me daily, calling me to come and capture it, to capture her, as it filled me with the longing of the reward of seeing her fully. So what do? I fly towards her and chase her with my purpose." Dione shook her head in pity. "Dione, my way is different from yours. Surely you're wise enough to see this. And also to, yes, well, to allow it," he said. "Allow me my purpose, Dione, I beg of you." That was before he proposed. But there was that part about the day that I think maybe amplifies what Aphrodite says when she's grateful for the gift of the day from her mother. Yeah. But I still don't know what she means when she says, "We know."
Well, the lunar consciousness would have moved into the solar day, isn't it?
Well, it would seem so. I know there's nocturnal mind in Earth goddess and in Aphrodite. And but I think it's the practical, from an earth point of view, it's the theater of the present moment, more that than solar.
Mm-hmm. Earlier she said, Dione said to Zeus about knowing, about seeing.
Oh, yes.
So maybe it has to do with the day to know.
can see that you.
Yes. Yes, where she describes how she knows. How she knows things. Yes.
I was just saying, I'm not sure about, this is just my own idea of intuition as a way of knowing that is really powerful, and it is the present moment of knowing. And it's the kind of knowing that Castaneda talks about, where you know, I mean, nothing will unconvince you because you know that that's a way of knowing that's just as important and valuable as the logic of things. And that seems to me like it's that kind of moment. And it's the present moment. I mean, it's that first thing.
Yeah, present moment.
Which is wisdom.
Yeah. Yes, all right.
When you read that, I was so touched. And I think if you start thinking, what does knowing mean? You just reduce it. It just.
Yes.
That touched me so much. I just. I felt chills. And I. When she said, we know, it was. I mean, I don't know what. We knew, but.
Yes.
It was wonderful.
Yes. Maybe it also refers to that certain satisfaction in what is known or what is held about the nature of things. What we know is enough and satisfying, which is not against a logos or thinking, but different.
She wants to learn out of wisdom, and they know that to love is wise. The experience of the moment where plan or something, then you have to plot and plan things out. And then there's something is lost in there. Or I think that's what they say with women, kind of like the 10 foolish virgins, or here it is down true mythology, and that the wise seizes the moment as they did, the moment of love. The woman knows this is what you do, or it doesn't come. And there's wisdom in, which is what that lady said, the intuition, seizing the moment, that love has to be spontaneous, it's boober. Grace, you can't force it, grace just comes, that moment is just spontaneous, and just comes, and the wisdom of knowing that, not search, you can't search for it.
Right. Well, we really do need to take a break, and yes.
I don't know how many of you were here last year or not, but what Betty is reading, you know, the dialogue she's reading, she has written, and these are really beautiful and wonderful, witty and wise. Last year, when she was here, she talked to us about the myth of Io. And it being the journey of the feminine and the feminine initiation. And this is to be a book, the book of Io. And I'm just waiting for the day when these dialogues get published, because I've heard so many of them, and they're so witty and so wonderful and so wise. And these are Betty's words, what we're hearing. And I just wanted you all to know that. And I was looking for the story of Io. She gets turned into a heifer, a beautiful white cow. Zeus is trying to protect her from Hera's wrath, and I finally found a little.
Oh, that's wonderful!
And I want to give this to you.
Oh, that's thank you.
But this also. So that we all hold these thoughts that these that Betty keeps working and holding the idea of the book in her mind, so that we have access to them on the printed page.
All right, I'm working on it slowly. Thank you. That's marvelous. I love the look on her face. Who wanted the section on knowing? You wanted it, and one other person wanted the section on knowing. Let's see.
Thank you.
that you had referred to it two places. It seemed like you were talking about that first part in the dialogue about words with
a statement about that she was not surprised at the stranger's coming, and he wondered at that, and she said, it was through my oracle that I knew. And someone asked me if I would read these words again about knowing. This is a very short passage, and asked me to read it slowly. Yes, Dione said, it was through my oracle that I knew. Knowing is a thing like glass, in which the light finds no obstruction, none whatsoever. Knowing is a thing like glass, in which the light finds no obstruction. Knowing passes through so many walls. Walls of sound, walls of sound as the beating of wings or the trembling of oak leaves. Knowing penetrates soft walls of flesh and even hard walls of old belief may not stand against it. Knowing penetrates soft walls of flesh and even hard walls of old belief may not stand against it. Now, was that the section that you think that was it? There was a statement by Zeus of what the word was like. Is that what you mean?
Would you read that just one more time?
About the word? The knowing? The knowing? All right, knowing. Knowing is a thing like glass in which the light finds no obstruction, none whatsoever. Knowing passes through so many walls. Walls of sound, as the beating of wings or the trembling of oak leaves. Knowing penetrates soft walls of flesh, and even hard walls of old belief may not stand against it.
Sort of knowing.
Well, I think that's just it. It's, if it could be objectively defined, I wouldn't need the description. I can't say what kind of knowing that is. It's a knowing that comes with a certain clarity, that she's trying to describe the light, a sense of light that comes with knowing. Something that is illuminating, where the knowing is really illuminating. Not I figured something out, but and I certainly wouldn't assign it to one function. I wouldn't think of assigning it to thinking or intuition alone. I don't think it's just the operation of a function. And
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.